Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Children growing up in our region today face tough challenges. This is especially true for those who are born into families struggling with drug addiction.
And if you don't stand up to protect these children, there's nobody else that's going to stand up to protect the kids.
And the drug crisis is pushing an increasing number of children into foster care.
We just need to get these kids in permanent homes as fast as we can so that they can just heal. If they've been taken away because of neglect and abuse, then we need to get therapy and let them do that. But they can't do it while they're jumping from placement to placement or going home and coming back. And I think we just really need to put the kids first.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we'll learn more about how children are being affected by the opioid epidemic and what's being done to help them.
How much is heroin a part of what you do?
Daily.
Daily.
I think our high watermark day was 18 overdoses within 24 hours.
This is Mark Strickland, an EMS supervisor for the fire department in Charleston, West Virginia. He's speaking with Anna Sale, host of WNYC's podcast, Death, Sex, and Money. We'll hear more from their conversation in the second half of our show. What Mark just said, though, that dealing with drug overdoses is a regular part of his job, well, this is not, unfortunately, a new story for those of us who live here in Appalachia. It's a struggle we share with many other parts of the nation. But Appalachia is sometimes referred to as ground zero for the opioid epidemic. According to data from the CDC, there's been a surge in overdose deaths across the nation. The death rates involving opioids are five times what they were back in 1999. And year after year, Appalachia suffers from some of the worst statistics. In 2016, West Virginia had the highest overdose death rate in the country. For every 2,000 people in the state, one died from an overdose. Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Kentucky also have some of the highest rates of deaths caused from drug overdose. As we know here in Appalachia, these death rates are more than numbers. It's our friends, brothers, neighbors, classmates, and coworkers, and people of all ages. On today's show, we'll hear more about what children are going through because of the crisis, starting with the youngest, babies. As the opioid epidemic has grown in Appalachia, so has the number of babies born dependent on drugs. They have what's called neonatal abstinence syndrome, also known as NAS. A variety of medical experts and nurses have been trying to find the best way to help these babies, and a number of different treatment programs have cropped up across Appalachia. But as Carol Lofton reports, there isn't agreement on the best way to care for these babies or their mothers.
A young mom, we'll call her patient A, is sitting on a couch holding her infant son at Karen's Place, the newest inpatient treatment program for pregnant women in Louisa, Kentucky.
Well, I have struggled with addiction for almost 10 years now. I guess mostly opiates, which, you know, turned into heroin.
She smiles down at the healthy infant in her arms, then begins to talk about her older son, now 2.5.
He was actually born addicted. I could not quit when I was pregnant with him, as much as I wanted to and as much as, you know, my mind told me every single day that I could. I was just under the grips of, this disease, and there was no way that I could.
She says she went to treatment when her oldest was 6 weeks old and stayed for a year, but relapsed during her second pregnancy.
I don't think any mother wants to have a baby with NAS, as we call it, neonatal abstinence syndrome.
That's Maria Mescola, a high-risk obstetrician based in Wisconsin, talking about neonatal abstinence syndrome, where babies born to drug-addicted mothers go through withdrawal. If someone is addicted to opioids and wants to get clean, there are generally two approaches to initial treatment: medically supervised cold turkey, so to speak, or medication-assisted tapering. But things get a little tricky when the addict is pregnant.
When patients undergo detoxification or complete withdrawal, even a supervised withdrawal, the risk, probably the greatest risk and the most common risk, is that of relapse.
In 2012, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists came out with a committee opinion on opioid abuse, dependence, and addiction in pregnancy. Their conclusion?
Balance of the evidence strongly supports the opioid-assisted treatments during pregnancy for the stability that it offers.
But if a woman participates in an opioid replacement therapy program while pregnant, even though she isn't using illegally anymore, her baby will likely be born with symptoms of neonatal abstinence syndrome.
And we know that it is best for babies to be born drug-free.
That's Kim Miller, Director of Corporate Development for Prestera Center in Huntington.
So even if a pregnant mom was addicted to drugs and had the disease of addiction earlier on in the pregnancy, if she can deliver a drug-free baby, she saves the baby from medical interventions, she saves herself, and she saves society. It's expensive to put babies in neonatal intensive care units, especially for a problem that is preventable.
Data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that the national average hospital charge for a baby being treated for neonatal abstinence syndrome is around $93,000. The average cost of a woman going through Prestera's inpatient treatment program, about $14,600 for an average stay of around 6 months. But getting women off drugs before the birth of their child isn't always easy or advisable.
My name is David Chafin. I'm the director of maternal fetal medicine at Marshall University.
Chafin says for appropriately, i.e. self-motivated women, tapering doses can allow a mother to be off drugs completely by the time her child is born.
This is not a inpatient 72-hour detox program. That stress, i.e. just going cold turkey, probably does carry some fetal risk. But the slower detoxification programs are safe to use.
He emphasizes that, in his opinion, requiring detox through a court order or obstetrician encouragement is dangerous, because if the mom isn't invested in her own recovery, the risk of relapse is really high. To prevent relapse, Chafin says, not only do mothers need to be ready to get clean, but centers like Prestera and Karen's Place that include long-term intensive counseling and support services are vital for success. But they're not nearly enough of these programs, and Appalachia has been hit really hard by the opioid crisis. At Cabell Huntington Hospital, where Chafin works, 140 out of 1,000 births are babies with neonatal abstinence syndrome. Nationwide, the number is around 6 per 1,000 births. So centers are coming up with a variety of ways to treat these patients. One doing things a little bit differently is Crosswinds outside Lewisburg. Noel Jewell is the medical director there.
Mostly in the first trimester, we're looking to detox completely off.
And what does that mean? Detox means different things for different people.
With detox, we're going to zero. So when they leave, they're not on any other medications other than prenatal vitamins or any other medications their OB would like them on.
Jewel does use buprenorphine, which is also known by the brand name Naloxone, to ease the symptoms of withdrawal. But unlike Chafin, where a detox tapering can take 10 to 12 weeks, Jewel does it in 5 to 7 days. Then the patients are monitored for a minimum of 72 hours, with an average total stay of around 10 to 15 days, and released back to the care of an obstetrician.
Now, I will admit that our first priority is trying to have a baby delivered without neonatal abstinence syndrome.
Up until this point, he says they've been really successful in reducing the number of NAS babies. Partially, he thinks, because they have really strong OBGYN support from local doctors. I asked him if he shares Chafin and Mescola's fears about relapse after an abstinence treatment program like his. He says relapse is definitely a concern.
Detox is just one part of it.
The other part? Counseling. Jewel acknowledges that Crosswinds treatment protocols differ from what the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists recommends. But, he says, there isn't a lot of definite data one way or another. For one thing, some of the studies ACOG referenced in their 2012 recommendations are pretty old, like written in the 1980s.
We as clinicians have an opportunity to start setting the trend, I mean, to start seeing what works and what doesn't work. I mean, we could wait till ACOG comes out with something, or wait till the study is published, or we can start trying to collect some of that data and see if there's a better way to do it.
Maria Mescola, the obstetrician in Wisconsin, is part of the new ACOG committee reviewing the 2012 guidelines to see if they need to be updated. For her, opioid replacement therapy for the entirety of the pregnancy is still the best practice. But, she says, she also hopes physicians like Chafin and Jewell publish their research, because this problem isn't going away, and more research and data helps everyone determine what works well and what doesn't. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Kara Lofton.
That story originally aired in April 2017. Afterwards, we received comments from listeners suggesting the term born addicted is problematic. And the NPR Ethics Guidebook suggests that journalists avoid the term because although babies may be born dependent on drugs and may suffer from withdrawal symptoms, they don't know what drugs are and can't obtain and use drugs to support an addiction. We want to hear what you think. How do you think medical doctors and nurses can best help babies and their mothers get the care they need? What types of resources do you think could help in your community? Write us your thoughts. We are at insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Sometimes babies who are born to mothers or fathers addicted to drugs suffer a second type of trauma. They're taken from their parents and placed in foster homes. Throughout Central Appalachia, thousands of children are in foster care, and the opioid epidemic is sending thousands more to join them. 2 years ago on Inside Appalachia, we heard from a foster family named the Holbins, who live in Kearneysville, West Virginia, up in the Eastern Panhandle. Their story showed us the strain the opioid epidemic is having on the foster care system. We now check back in with that family to explore what lies ahead in combating this crisis. Reporter Liz McCormick brings us this story.
Stay-at-home mom and daycare provider Jen Holden lives in Kearneysville, Jefferson County, with her six kids. They're like any other family. They joke with each other, share meals, laugh, play, and watch movies together. They love church, and they're actively involved at school and within the community. But Jen is also a former foster parent who, for 14 years, along with her ex-husband, fostered 27 children ranging in age from infant to 18.
I had heard adoption stories, and I really started to think, I would like to adopt. And when I started to research, I really didn't know much about the foster care system at all, but when I would type in adoption, foster care would come up. And I educated myself, and I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to help children.
Jen also has two biological sons who are in high school. Of the 27 children she's fostered, she adopted four, three of whom were exposed to drugs or alcohol in utero.
My youngest was born addicted to three different drugs. And he was in the hospital for 3 weeks, and when he came home from the hospital, he screamed for 4 months straight until he really got off the drugs. Right now, he's on target. He's really excelling and doing really well.
The two other children impacted by drugs or alcohol are biologically related sisters. The 9-year-old was born while her mother was addicted to heroin. Jen says she's doing well, but will likely need ongoing help in school. Jen's other daughter, who's 11 years old, struggles a bit more.
She's probably on a second or third grade level and should be in the sixth grade. And she has fetal alcohol syndrome. She suffers from epilepsy from the fetal alcohol syndrome and is severely delayed.
Both girls also have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, and take medication for it. Jen says despite medical and academic struggles, she loves being a mom and watching her kids grow. But there are other kids in the foster care system, thousands in fact, who still need help. For Jen, the solution is making sure these kids are placed in a secure environment early and for the long term.
We just need to get these kids in permanent homes as fast as we can so that they can just heal. I mean, even if they're drug addicted, then they need to overcome that. If they've been taken away because of neglect and abuse, then we need to get therapy and let them do that, but they can't do it while they're jumping from placement to placement or going home and coming back. And I think we just really need to put the kids first.
But finding permanent homes is rarely easy. The West Virginia Children's Home Society, or CHS, is one of 10 agencies in the state that handle foster care referrals from the West Virginia Department of Health and Human Resources. The organization works to find the best matchups for children who need temporary or permanent placements, whether that's in traditional foster homes like Jen's or in other placements, such as with a relative or in emergency shelters. Chief Executive Officer of CHS, Steve Tuck, notes that in just just the last few years, there's been a dramatic spike in the number of children coming into care. This has made it harder to ensure these kids find adequate home environments. He says the opioid epidemic has played a major role in that rise.
The need has only gone up. The number in care had gone up close to 6,000 from what it had stabilized for many years at around 4,000 kids, state kids in care. It's even in these last few months, it's gone up almost 100 a month.
DHHR reported in November that nearly 6,400 West Virginia children are in foster care. That's about 1,000 more kids in care than November 2016. Tuck says it's hard to pinpoint just how many of those children are coming into care as a direct result of substance abuse. For example, if a child is pulled from a home because of some form of neglect, the role substance abuse played isn't always clearly noted. Likewise, when children are born with drug-related issues, there's no consistent methods for determining the extent of parental substance abuse. Tuck says to improve these situations, there needs to be more communication.
We all need to get together from the medical, especially the hospitals that are, you know, serving those situations and the ones that might need to take custody for children.
Despite the difficulties, Tuck argues the general consensus regarding the number of children coming into care due to substance abuse is at least 50%.
And I've seen numbers as high as 90, but that's really probably people's more anecdotal, you know, who've worked in this work a long time, acknowledgement that it almost affects every placement of children coming into care.
Tuck says one way to help limit the number of children needing to enter care is to start with the families. CHS, Marshall University, DHHR, and the Behavioral Health and Addiction Treatment Center, Prestera, are all working together on a pilot project to help addicted mothers get the care and therapy they need to get off drugs and keep their children. The pilot project has been launched in Cabell, Lincoln, and Wayne counties first, but Tuck hopes if it's successful, it will expand to all 55 counties. Tuck asks state lawmakers to keep the foster care system in mind this session.
My encouragement to them is really just to acknowledge that there's a lot higher cost to taking care of these kids, and there are West Virginia children that we all are responsible for, so they really have to look at that when most of the, you know, discussions are around budget cuts and reduced funding and things like that.
Back at the Holbens, Jen encourages more West Virginia families to think about becoming foster parents.
You hear all this stuff and it can scare you away, but it is the most rewarding. Every kid I've had has been a blessing to me. But definitely educate yourself so you're prepared for what you might deal with. And just always remember that a kid that comes to your house through foster care, through adoption, through anything, their story goes beyond the day you bring them home. And whether you bring them home as a baby, they still have biological parents that it's part of them and it's part of their story. Their story isn't just being in your home.
Still, Jen's biggest concern is ensuring the children who end up in West Virginia's foster care system are placed in permanent homes as soon as possible. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Liz McCormick.
According to the West Virginia Department of Health and Human Resources, of the more than 6,000 children in foster care, 50 are available for adoption. Visit our website at wvpublic.org for more information. In just a minute, we'll hear experts talk about why living with a parent battling addiction can be dangerous for a child. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we're examining how some of Appalachia's youngest generation are affected by the opioid epidemic. The science is clear. Addiction runs in families. It's not just opioids, but alcohol and even tobacco use, too. Carol Lofton takes a look at multi-generational addiction in West Virginia and the challenges families face to break these cycles.
We are in my apartment right now. It's through the Ray of Hope.
Brooke sits side by side with her mom on the couch at New Life Apartments. Ray of Hope is an addiction recovery center for women struggling with alcohol or drug abuse.
When I was 15, I had my wisdom teeth pulled out, and they gave me, this is like right before or the beginning of the OxyContin epidemic, so they gave me OxyContin. And it was just a sensation that you can't really explain. And it was like something changed in my mind. And after that, it was just kind of a slow process for a year or two. And then it was just full blown. I had to have it.
Meanwhile, Brooke's mom has her own struggles. She asked that we not use her name to protect her privacy. So we'll call her Martha.
I was dealing with losing my daughter to addiction. And of course, then I lost her father. He had an overdose. And so I was struggling to get through that, and I started drinking, and it made me feel better in the beginning, but, you know, relationships, family relationships, all the dynamics changed because of my drinking, and I was aware that it was happening, but on the other hand, it just made me feel better.
2 years after Brooke was first prescribed OxyContin, she tried heroin for the first time. She was 17.
I knew she was struggling at that point, and I truly tried to help her, but I was just enabling her addiction. And so therefore, because things so spiraled out of control so fast within the next couple of years, drinking really gave me some sort of relief at the time.
As family relationships began to strain and break under the weight of addiction, Brooke and her mom said they became a kind of team.
It was like we would enable each other toward the end. We were both aware, like at this point it was no secret, but it was like, well, you've got this and I've got that. So, you know, and they're real similar. So it was like kind of a bond almost, a really sick bond we had. We would defend each other at you know, to other people.
In a way, this isn't surprising.
Addiction clusters in families.
That's Laura Barut, a psychiatrist at the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, Missouri, who studies familial clustering of psychiatric illness and addiction.
And so the question is, why is it clustering in families? Is it the environment of the families, or is it the biology within families, the genetic predisposition?
In a nutshell, it's both. But what has dramatically changed in recent years is the introduction of widely available opioids.
We know that our genes actually haven't changed over the last 50 years, but we have this new opioid epidemic. And this opioid epidemic is because of environmental changes. The recent drive to prescribe medications over the past 15 years.
So Barut says when we see addiction clustering in families, Brooke's biological dad died of a heroin overdose, which later became her drug of choice, while her mom struggled with alcoholism. The magic combination is genetic susceptibility to addiction combined with the environmental change of more prescriptions.
So even though there's this biological predisposition running in families, we need to also think of the family as a unit of environment. It is very difficult for someone to become abstinent and enter recovery when other family members are using substances.
Remember what Brooke said?
It was like we would enable each other.
But when Brooke got into her latest round of treatment, there had been several, something shifted in not only her, but in her mom.
She would visit me, and when I got to, she was still drinking, and when I got to Ray of Hope, she started coming to meetings with me. And she then started, you know, continued her journey into her sobriety and quit drinking.
So we really do need to be looking at families when we're treating addiction and to know if there is a multi-generational substance use in that family, to really try to get everyone in that family into treatment and to, you know, encourage abstinence throughout all family members.
But ultimately, recovery is a personal decision. Brooke and her mom say their sobriety is not dependent on the other's decision not to use. If one of them relapses, they will still individually pursue recovery. In other families, though, recovery may mean cutting ties with those still using so that the unit of environment, so to speak, shifts in a more positive direction. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Carol Lofton.
This next story illustrates a dark reality for some children of addicted parents. A warning, this story may not be suitable for young listeners. So if kids are nearby, you might want to skip the next 4 minutes. The power of addiction often rips people of standards, morals, or compassion. And perhaps there's no story that helps to illustrate this power more than when a parent sells their child on the black market for sex. West Virginia's drug epidemic may be leading to increases in what's called familial sex trafficking. Family members sometimes trade sex with the child for drugs or money. But Kara Lofton reports spotting the problem and prosecuting the offenders is difficult.
Brian Morris says all forms of human trafficking, whether for labor or sex, are severely underreported in West Virginia. He's with the Department of Homeland Security, and he's co-chairing a state task force that's trying to figure out how common human trafficking is.
Most of what I see is familial trafficking, which is where the parents tend to prostitute their children out. And the reason that they do that is we are increasingly facing a drug epidemic in this state.
Morris says human trafficking is defined as the use of force, fraud, or coercion to obtain some type of labor or commercial sex act. Other members of the task force caution it's difficult to know how prevalent human trafficking is because local law enforcement is just beginning to know how to recognize it. But Crittenton Services, a residential treatment facility for girls ages 12 to 18, knows those signs all too well. 9 of the 30 girls living here now have a history of being sexually trafficked by family members. Laura Smith is a clinical therapist at Crittenton.
We have had young women who eventually, when they are able to tell us their stories, tell us stories of being in basements and having guns held to their head while they were having sex. And they're very aware that that's not what is supposed to be happening.
Smith says a lot of times the girls are not viewing this as something their family has done to them. In some cases, the young women develop a kind of relationship with their abusers, so they view a much older man as a boyfriend or a person that they love.
And sex is just a manifestation of that love. So in those cases, they don't understand mom or dad is getting money on the side from that relationship too. That part is kind of hidden usually when the girls feel like they're in a relationship with those individuals.
Smith says some young women arrive at Crittenton and not realize they've been trafficked.
And then it becomes a question of if we tell them that that's what's happened to them, is that further damaging their trauma and damaging what they've grown up with and those safety nets that they have? Or is it going to be useful to them in the long run to move on from it?
At the Huntington Police Department, Bob Leslie, a deputy with the West Virginia Attorney General's office, is leading a training for police officers on how to spot human trafficking. He says it's likely far more common than they realize.
We know that trafficking is the second largest criminal activity in the United States and in the world. Anybody want to hazard a guess as to what is the number one criminal activity in the United States? Somebody say heroin or somebody say drugs.
Leslie said last year, the task force trained nearly 3,000 people in West Virginia on how to spot human trafficking. Agent Brian Morris says the hope is that if people know what human trafficking looks like, West Virginia's reporting numbers and federal cases will also increase.
This is a human life that we are referring to. And if you don't stand up to protect these children, there's nobody else that's going to stand up to protect the kids.
But standing up for kids can be a bit of an uphill battle. In order to build a case, prosecutors need victims to testify, which is especially difficult when the perpetrator is a family member. So prevention is key, and prevention here, in part, means getting a grip on the opioid crisis. For NPR News, I'm Kara Lofton in Charleston, West Virginia.
In West Virginia, the Department of Health and Human Resources is responsible for taking care of children in foster care. Cabinet Secretary Bill Crouch says the responsibility is overwhelming because of the opioid epidemic. Health reporter Kara Lofton recently sat down with Crouch to find out more about what his department is doing to help these children when they need it the most.
The biggest problem is drugs, and it's affecting virtually every department in DHHR. We have 80% of our children in foster homes are from families who have had drug problems, either the overdoses by the mother or addiction by the mother. We have a large number of NAS babies, neonatal abstinence syndrome, and these babies need special care. So the problems are affected a lot by drugs. That's not our only problems. We have obesity in West Virginia. We're number one in obesity. We're number one in cardiovascular disease, number one in diabetes. So there are a lot of health problems that are difficult to tackle because they require a change in behavior. And changing people's behavior is one of the toughest things to do in healthcare.
One of the things that I'm hearing from health professionals who are dealing with the addiction problem that is in this state is not only how do we help change behavior of existing users, but how do we prevent future users and how do we impact West Virginia's youth? I mean, what is the DHHR's approach to that?
Yeah, our death rate in West Virginia to opioids and drugs is over twice the national average. We have a problem that I believe is a community problem. This has to happen from the bottom up, not the top down. We have to have change at the local level. So we're working on an approach that involves folks at the local level helping to tackle this problem. We need an intervention early on these issues.
So when you say approaching from the local level and from a community approach, I mean, those are pretty broad terms. Can you describe more specifically what you mean by that?
Well, that's what I've charged this department with, this office with developing. But it could include a social worker. It could include a professional from the local behavioral mental health program, behavioral health program. It could include someone from the local health department. It could include someone from emergency medical services. It needs to be a team of individuals who really are charged with going out and developing an intervention with an individual. A good example of what has happened in the past is in Huntington in August of last year, 2016, we had 26 individuals overdose within a few hours. Our Department of Public Health was contacted a few days later and asked to do an epidemiological study to determine the outcome of that and to determine any factors that might help prohibit that in the future. That report was done, I believe, completed in January, and it showed not one of those individuals went for treatment. So what that tells me is we need a local team at the local level to contact those folks immediately and see if we can get people into treatment sooner and convince them that is the way to go. They have to change that lifestyle. If nothing is done, in fact, we have a number of individuals who overdose two or three times a day, and so we have to have some intervention at the local level to have an impact on that.
West Virginia is a poor state, and we struggle with our economy. So when we're looking at interventions, which can be quite expensive, how does money and lack of money impact our ability to spread resources to those who might need them?
That's a great question. We started out last year's budget, as you probably know, with a $500 million deficit. It looks like we're gonna start out the next fiscal year with a $250 or $280 million deficit. So we don't have a lot of money. The legislature played a great role in the last session in passing a bill called the Ryan Brown Fund, in which settlement money from the pharmaceutical companies was placed into an account called the Ryan Brown account to be used to develop treatment beds in West Virginia. That is one of the areas that we're lacking. We don't have enough treatment beds in West Virginia for folks that need those treatment beds. Even when you get them, when you convince them that they need treatment, we have to have a place to place those individuals. So that was a big help. But we're struggling with the cost of this this public health problem in West Virginia. We get funds from the federal government from time to time, and we look for every grant we can get to try to provide funds down at the local level to combat this problem. But it's a barrier to fixing the problem.
Let's swing back around to kind of what you do as secretary and some of the things that you encounter. What are the biggest challenges of your job?
the biggest is probably the responsibility for the children that DHHR is responsible for caring for through the foster care program and others, residential programs. I really had no idea of the amount of responsibility that involves. So that's been a little eye-opener to me.
Foster care and caring for children is something you've mentioned a couple of times. So let's talk about this a little bit. What's happening with West Virginia's children?
We have a large number of children who are there because of the drug problem. We have more than doubled the number of children in foster care in the last 10 years. We do not have enough foster families. Many of our children now end up going to extended families, either grandparents, aunts, uncles. We're trying to recruit more foster families, but that's difficult. It's a large responsibility. It's a huge burden, but it's amazing the number of folks who have stepped up and who are trying to help children. It is not an easy thing to do. We seem to have a lack of placement in a lot of the areas that we're responsible for. We're examining that right now to look and see if there is more we can do in that area.
Again, that was Bill Crouch, the West Virginia DHHR's cabinet secretary, speaking with West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Kara Lofton. You can find more of Kara's health reporting on our website, wvpublic.org. Look for her series called Appalachia Health News, which is produced with support from Marshall Health, Charleston Area Medical Center, and WVU Medicine. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Mark Strickland works at the fire department in Charleston, West Virginia. On the front lines, he sees firsthand, day after day, people battling addiction, overdosing, and dying from drugs. But as Strickland told Anna Sale on an episode of Death, Sex, and Money, the most difficult calls involve children. Let's listen.
How much is heroin a part of what you do?
Daily.
Daily.
I think our high water mark day was 18 overdoses within 24 hours.
This is Mark Strickland. He's an EMS supervisor for the fire department in Charleston, West Virginia, where I'm from. These days, he spends a lot of his time reviving people who've overdosed on opiates and dealing with them when they wake up.
Having to wrestle with people, fight because they've come out of an overdose, combative, they're scared. The last thing they knew, they're committing a felony because they're shooting heroin up their arm. So, I mean, we all roll up dressed in navy blue. Hell, we look like cops. So we have to be able to calm people down, because if they get up and run out in the middle of the street scared and get hit by a car, we've not done our jobs.
I talked with Mark at a firehouse in Charleston. He's 41 and has been a first responder for nearly 20 years. He typically works 24 hours on, 48 hours off. With his wife, he's raising three boys, not far from this firehouse.
I decided that I wanted to be a fireman when I was 5 years old. My dad was a volunteer fireman in a small town where we grew up, Glendenning. And I would always be with him when he'd go to the firehouse or go on calls. And I thought that was a pretty exciting life.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I got into that. And it was, not to sound like a Hallmark card, but it was a way to help people. You're given everything you've got to help people in distress, no matter what it may be. And our job is very simple. You listen to a voice to come out of a speaker in a radio, and they tell you where to go and what they presume to be wrong. So you find out what's going on with whomever, and you address their emergency, and you stop loss right there, whether it's a fire, a heart attack, an overdose, whatever's wrong in their life.
You said stop loss?
Stop loss. You put the fire out where it is.
Drug overdose deaths in the U.S. have skyrocketed in the last 5 years, but they're the highest in West Virginia. The overdose death rate here was nearly three times the national average in 2015, the last year complete CDC data is available. It wasn't like this when I lived here. And it also wasn't like this when Mark was first training to become a paramedic in the late 90s. He learned how to use Narcan, a life-saving drug that blocks opioid receptors. But back then, he rarely used it.
It would expire on the shelves. We didn't go to heroin overdoses or opiate overdoses all that often. And now I'm keeping preloads of Narcan in the driver's door of my cruiser at work.
When did you notice that the job of first responders in this community was starting to change because of drug use?
In the late 90s, early 2000s, clandestine meth labs became all the rage. Meth moved in the community, the shake and bake cooking, one pot cooking, the clandestine labs. We started encountering those.
I remember that. That's when I was living here. And,
right.
And there was the issue of not only like fires, but they were hazardous waste zones too.
Absolutely.
For you.
If you didn't go in and get exposed through the smoke, if we went in, a lot of times people would call in an odor, a chemical odor. It was just awful.
So when did you notice that shift into something different?
As that was being addressed, the trend of prescription drug abuse was rearing up, was ramping up. Some doctors with ill-gotten gain in mind would open pill mills, and they just rent a building and put a sign outside that said, you know, Dr. Smith Pain Clinic. And you could come in and say, my back hurts, here's $100, and he'd write you a prescription. And the DEA, local law enforcement, state law enforcement, and a bunch of people started talking back and forth, said, hey, we're having all these people overdosing on opiates. To hell, we gotta do something. Well, I know what we'll do. We'll stamp out the pill mills. And they did. The bad thing was the addicts remain. But my, if you will, patient zero for this heroin, people use the word epidemic. My patient zero was in a house on the west side of Charleston.
Not far from here, then.
Not far from here at all. Picture, if you will, the white-sided wood frame house, swear to God, white picket fence, morning glories growing in it, right? Car in the driveway, nice and washed, nice home. We get called for the possible deceased person. And this is like 4 in the morning. And I go into this house, lights are on, and a woman sitting at the kitchen table, of course, has been crying. My ambulance crew beat me. They were there and standing over top of this gentleman in the floor, laying on his right side, obviously deceased. And one of the young guys we had on the ambulance said, hey, Captain, what's this? And he pointed to the desk, and there's a cap of a needle, two other needles that were unused, a tourniquet, and then an open and two unopened bindles of dope. They'd crimped off two ends of a drinking straw, and there's dope in the middle of it. I looked back at the patient, and I looked back at the wife, and I said, ma'am, how long has this guy used heroin? And she started crying. I said, look, I'm not judging. I'm just asking a question. I mean, I got heroin here in the desk. I got a needle cap. I'm going to guess when I roll him over, I'm going to find a needle in his arm. How long has he done drugs? And she just started bawling, crying, said, since he came home from Vietnam, he's used therapeutically heroin. He's always gone out of town to get it. He's never sold it. He doesn't deal it. He doesn't get it. It just keeps him stable. So I asked her, I said, where did he get this? Where did he get this? This is usual stuff. And she told me, no, his dealer gave him those for free and asked him to use them and that it was something new and wanted him to put the price on it. And it registered in my head, if this guy's done heroin since 1970, God knows what, but this stuff killed him, lickety-split, half of this stuff killed him. He didn't even get the whole shot in his arm. What's new about this stuff compared to anything else? And from there, I noticed it being an everyday event.
Specific to the calls where you're watching people who are nearly dead, mm-hmm. you're bringing them back to life, and you find them again nearly dead. Mm-hmm. Does it feel like you have a really close-up view on something that's, like, kind of breaking down?
Very much so. On those calls, a lot of times I've walked out feeling as much of an enabler as the dealers on the street, because if I just show up and shove some Narcan in your arm and, you better now? You good? You're going to be sick later. see you, and walk out, what the hell have I done? Now, given the only thing you need to be to go to rehab is alive, you got to have a pulse to get in rehab. That's handy. So if I don't go out and do my job assessing the human body in front of me and give Narcan an opiate overdose and get them alive, then they're never going to have the chance to go to rehab. And we've heard the commentary, both locally and nationally, oh, you shouldn't do that. You're just wasting money on these people. You just all let them die. If they've overdosed twice, you should just not have to Narcan them again. You get 3 strikes in life, right? Well, I don't know, do you? How many diabetics do we go to that, oh, you know what? You let your sugar drop again because you didn't take your insulin right. So now I've got to give you D50. I've done that to you twice. Time for you to die. Seriously. How many of those patients do you say, mm-mm, 2 bites of the apple, you're done. So who are we to judge a person, rich, poor, black, white, Jew, Christian, Muslim? I don't care. They're a human being.
Do you think you're stopping loss?
I don't know. The left side, right side, the left side, the bleeding heart, save the world side says you're giving people the chance to go to rehab, to change their ways, to be a productive citizen. You're giving that kid his father back, even if for another day. You're helping that family recover. EMS is doing their part to stop loss. We're preventing deaths from overdoses. And that's the left side, bleeding heart, unicorns and rainbows. The dark side says, yeah, all we're doing is perpetuating a problem. We're keeping more addicts on the street. If there weren't as many customers, there wouldn't be the industry for dealers because all the patients would be dead. So why should we pay our taxes for our cities, our counties, our states to buy Narcan to put on ambulances because you want to go commit a felony and you want to go shoot heroin? We've had many people, many patients that we've run 2 and 3 and 4 times, my high water mark on repeat offenders or frequent flyer customers, however you want to look at it, was 11. I ran a guy 11 times.
Did he make it?
Yeah. Probably the thing that makes me the most mad and the ones that piss me off are the ones involving kids, when kids are home. And
Reddick 437, engine 452, attention 408, Cross Street, Anaconda Avenue, Glover Street. 27-year-old male, cardiac arrest.
That's an overdose.
1129.
I'll be back.
You need to go?
Yeah, that's a heroin overdose. I'll bet you paycheck.
I met Mark for the first time when I was back home in Charleston last month. When he got the interview request from us, at first he thought the email from Death, Sex, and Money was some kind of prank from the guys at work. In a follow-up email, I proved my local cred by telling him where I went to high school. I've become used to updates from home about someone I knew or someone I knew's little brother or sister dying of an overdose. It's not just in West Virginia, of course, but the current opioid epidemic has its roots in this part of the country. And it's been this way for years now, so much so that you can almost become numb to it. I wanted to hear from someone who can't ignore it. And that led me to Mark. After the call came over the radio about the 27-year-old man in cardiac arrest, Mark jumped into a fire truck with some of his colleagues, and they were gone. We waited at the firehouse, and Mark was back within an hour.
Sorry about that.
Don't apologize.
Mark told me a woman had called 911 when she found her boyfriend unconscious.
Boyfriend was sleeping over his girlfriend's house, and she went to check on her 3-year-old son in the other room and noticed that he wasn't breathing too well and called 911 and thought he was dead, and he was breathing about 4 times a minute and ashen and gray looking, kind of sweaty, and his percentage of oxygen in his bloodstream was less than 50%, so we controlled his airway and used a bag valve mask and breathed for him and started an IV. Pushed some Narcan, and he woke up.
And you said there was a 3-year-old in the house?
There was. He was in the other room. He was in his room playing, and his mom kept him away and didn't let him see and what have you. But that's just, those are the tough ones for us, is this well-intentioned mother trying to make it. Her boyfriend's in there shooting up heroin in her house, and now we've got to report that to CPS.
To Child Protective Services.
Right.
Had you seen this particular guy before?
No, he just got out of prison for drug distribution charges.
That was Mark Strickland, who works at the fire department in Charleston, speaking with Anna Sale, host of Death, Sex, and Money. You can find the rest of this episode and all other Death, Sex, and Money episodes at deathsexmoney.org or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You've been Inside Appalachia as we examine how opioids are affecting children. As a mother, it's heartbreaking to hear these stories. We've got a Goliath to deal with here in Appalachia and across the country. We'd love to know your thoughts. Tell us how addiction has touched your life or the lives of children you know. Do you have any creative ways to help these kids? Send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WNYC and their podcast, Death, Sex, and Money, and Appalachia Health News. Our theme music is by Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd and I produce Inside Appalachia. Ibi Caputo edited our episode this week. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us online on Twitter at @InAppalachia. Our mailing address is West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. Our email is insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. If you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget you can subscribe or download all of our stories on iTunes, Downcast, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Well, I ain't got no money, ain't got no home, and I ain't got nobody I can call my own. I'm satisfied, got nothing to do. But long for a dime for that Red Mountain wine. Got a farm in West Virginia and a home in Tennessee. Boxcar in Missouri and a jet in Waikiki. But I'm satisfied, got nothing to do but pawn for a dime for that Red Mountain wine. Got nothing to do but pawn for a dime for that Red Mountain wine.